this session with Sayers tonight. Usually I talk mostly about the Lord Peter Wimsey novel. But I thought that since there was some interest in gender from those quotes that I read at Vespers a week and a half ago, talk more tonight about Sayers as a theologian. But I will say a few things about the Wimsey novels and about Sayers herself for those of you who are not acquainted with her, because you really should get acquainted with her. And the Wimsey novels are a terrific way to do it because they're delightful and entertaining and substantial, and they're the kinds of books that can be read again and again and again. I'm a fanatic, so it's again ad infinitum. I don't know how many times I've read them. But Dorothy Sayers was English, and she was born on June 13, 1893 in Oxford. Her father was an Anglican priest. She was an only child. She died in December of 1957. She was 64. She grew up, her father was a sort of like the Oxford equivalent of a campus pastor, I guess, when she was born. And he soon after that left Oxford and went to the west of England and took a very meager parish, because he felt that was his duty to do so, out in a part of the country that she uses in her novel, The Nine Tailors. And Dorothy was pretty much educated by her father. She did finally go to boarding school when she was older. She didn't get along very well there. She went up on a scholarship to Oxford, and this was before, it was when they let women in at Oxford, but they didn't give them degrees yet. Sayers went, I believe, in 1914, something like that. And there had been women going to Oxford since about 1890, but they didn't give them degrees until 1920. And then in 1920, all the women who had earned their degrees up until then got their degrees. And Sayers earned in England, in university, you know, like we get degrees with honors here, or just degrees or whatever, they get first, second, and third class degrees, and first class being the first, the best. And Sayers earned a first in French literature, medieval French literature, and the French language, which she later used in, she translated, did a translation of the Song of Roland, which is a early medieval French epic. That's still in print. Penguin books still coming. After Oxford, she taught for about a year in France. World War I had broken out, and it was just before the war, and she went to France and taught there for a year, taught English, and then she came back to England, and she got a job in an advertising agency in London, where she worked for 10 years. And it was while she was working there that she started writing the Lord Peter Wimsey novels. And they were almost an instant success. People fell in love with Lord Peter. Sayers tired of Lord Peter after a while, but her public kept demanding more. And so there are a total of 11 novels and, 25, 30 short stories, and plus various and sundry other things. She did the last novel, Busman's Honeymoon, was originally a play that she wrote with a friend of hers. But get into the Wimsey novels. They're fun. We've got them all in the bookstore. We've got them all, two or three copies of each, I think, in the library. And I recommend you read them in order. They're in order in the bookstore. Don't pay attention to Harper and Rowe's numbers in the corner. They don't mean anything. Hmm. But I go in and rearrange them periodically. But the first one is Whose Body? It doesn't really matter that you read them in order. A lot of people read The Nine Tailors first. That's probably the best one of the lot.
It's what's
the Nine Tailors, it's called. And that's been acclaimed as one of the great mystery and detective novels of all time. And but there are four that you should read in order, and you can ask me later. I'll put a little note down in the bookstore or something. And that's Strong Poison, Have His Carcass, Gaudy Night, and Busman's Honeymoon. And that's because it's in those four novels that Sayers develops Lord Peter Wimsey's relationship with Harriet Vane, who's this woman he falls in love with. And she does that very, very well. And so it's important to read them in order. You know, it's not your typical fiction romance by any means. It's a very realistic kind of thing. Well, they're both, you know, they're Harriet's in her early 30s, Peter's pushing 40 when it all starts. And, you know, it's really very, very well done. And that's one thing, Sayers' characters, you know, one reason the Lord Peter books are so popular, I think, is because you really feel like you know Lord Peter Wimsey, you know. And all the people in the books, those of you that have read the novels know that, you know, the characters are really alive, you know. Miss Clemson and Bunter and Parker and everybody else, you know, they're really fun. And I want to read you just one little thing about that. And this is a biography. We have this in paper cover also in the bookstore. It's called Such a Strange Lady, written by a woman named Janet Hitchman. It came out in 1973. And Sayers specified, although she didn't put it in her will, but she said it several times, that she didn't want a biography written about her until she'd been dead for 50 years. Well, that would be the year 2007. And since the detective novels were so popular, especially, maybe some of you saw them, there were four of them that were put on by Masterpiece Theater on public television. And maybe you got in on those. They were well done. And the novels got, they were real popular and stuff. So Harper and, well, an English publisher first, and then Harper and Row in this country, got this woman to write this biography. It's not very good. Sayers wouldn't have liked it. But on the other hand, it's good because it gives you some insight into her character. And she was a strange lady, a real weirdo. And to some extent, you know, but I mean, who isn't? You know, I mean, we've all got our quirks. She was, you know, she was fun. She's a big lady. She's about 6 feet tall and, you know, weighed a couple hundred pounds. And if you know anything about the English Roman Catholic apologist, G.K. Chesterton, who's also written Father Brown Mysteries and all this other stuff, Chesterton was a very big man. And they all belonged to a, well, Chesterton started it. It was called the, what was it called? Help. Anyway, it was a bunch of, oh, I can't remember. That's terrible.
The Inklings?
No, not the Inklings. It was a bunch of mystery writers that all, they had a club.
Oh.
It was called the Detection Club. That's what it was called. And Chesterton founded it, and he was the president. And they had all these big, you know, ceremonies and stuff they went through, and they brought new writers in that said that essentially they had to take an oath that all their plots would be worked out, you know, that all the clues would be present for everybody all the time, and they wouldn't use mumbo jumbo or acts of God or, you know, weird things to come in and make the plot different than as it should logically come out. And they had to swear they'd do that, and they had this big ritual. And Sayers eventually became president of the Detection Club. And she was just delighted because she fit perfectly into G.K. Chesterton's robes. And Chesterton was really a huge man, so that gives you an indication. She was a very large lady. She was married to, he was a weirdo too. They had a very strange relationship. But after she quit the advertising agency, she had made enough money with the Lord Peter Wimsey novels that she just, that's all she did for the rest of her life was write. Did all kinds, she did tons of stuff. I'll get into a little more of what she did. First, I want one little thing about the Wimsey novels. In the beginning of this book, and she deals mainly with the novel. She doesn't touch the theology much, which is good, because the few comments she makes, it's a good thing she didn't. She really doesn't know what she's talking about. But at one point, she talks about the redemption of sin, and if it's sin that's redeemed, we're all in trouble. But her first paragraph is called Wimsey Lives, and she talks about Oxford. Sayers dearly loved Oxford. Not only was she born there, but she went to college there, and those were like some of her happiest years, and really enjoyed that. And this woman talks about that Oxford in the summertime, the tourist season, part of the wives of the professors in Oxford, part of their job is to take guests that come, you know, that are known to people in the various colleges around Oxford and show them all the sights and tell them all the history and do this stuff. And she tells this story about this one professor's wife in Oxford. You should know one thing probably, that a warden is like the president of a college. But and this gal's name is Catherine. It says, normally this sightseeing stuff was a chore Catherine enjoyed, for she loved Oxford and love is nothing unless shared. But this afternoon was different. The college had produced a middle-aged married couple, white South Africans from Johannesburg. They did not seem to be at all academic. She could not find out whom they were attached to, parents of a Rhodes Scholar, important beneficiaries. A couple the warden of the college had met on his travels and gaily asked to look him up if they ever came his way. Whoever they were not entranced with Oxford. The streets were so narrow, the buildings so low. Compared with Johannesburg, it was really the pits. Well, I won't translate that, but anyway. They were unimpressed by the Bodleian, which is the library. The Radcliffe Camera was not what they had expected. Christchurch was pretty. The glorious vaulting of the cathedral choir a bit too fancy. Nothing brought forth a spark of enthusiasm. Well, Hetty, the man said after every stage, we've seen that, and mentally ticked it off. Catherine racked her brains for stories of scholars and martyrs. Even the practical jokes were dragged out. A polite, oh yes, was all she received in return. The hot afternoon was a dreary failure, and it was still too early to suggest tea. Seeking some shade and relief from traffic noise, she led them off Cat Street into New College Lane, thinking she would show them Magdalen College and the river. As they passed under the bridge, she said casually, this is where Lord Peter Wimsey and Harriet Vane became engaged. It was as if an electric charge had entered the couple. Enthusiasm so lacking about reality bubbled over when the fictional pair was mentioned. After the concert, exclaimed the woman. Yes, cried the man, and that Mr. Proctor caught them at it. Not Mr. Proctor, said Catherine gently. A proctor, a sort of college policeman. But they were not really listening. They were gazing in awe at the blackened stones of the bridge, murmuring reverentially, so this is the very place. Now they had to see everything, even if it meant going back to scenes already visited. And so they went to Balliol, where in 1912 Lord Peter Wimsey graduated with first-class honors in the School of Modern History, to the Scottish baronial excrescences of Alfred Waterhouse, which were adjudged so right for such a noble personage, and to Somerville College, the original of Shrewsbury College in Gaudy Knight, Harriet Vane's alma mater, which also received enthusiastic attention. Now and again, Catherine felt constrained to murmur, but they were not real, you know, just people in books. But to this couple, the only real things about Oxford were Peter Wimsey and Harriet Vane. More real, perhaps, than their creator, whose memorial tablet in Somerville Chapel received perfunctory attention, Dorothy Leigh Sayers. Anyway, I think that gives you a fine indication of just how real these characters become. And they do. Sometimes it's kind of scary. I have to put off rereading the novel sometimes. But Sayers, like I said, she got tired of Lord Peter Wimsey, and she admits, too, in several places that that's one thing she did just to make some money, you know. But she also enjoyed mystery fiction very, very much. She put together a book called The Omnibus of Crime, which traces the history of detective fiction, you know, all the way from the Bible, you know. We've got a couple great mystery novels in stories in the Apocrypha, and Bell and the Dragons one, and things like that. And but her main interest was being a Christian apologist doing literary criticism in her time and things like that. She was very, as she grew older, she was very upset by the 20th century. Granted, she was a medieval scholar, you know, and things, and Anna, and she did a translation of Dante in her later years, and very much into that. But she thought the 20th century had become a little too flippant. I think she's right on there. Some of that stuff, if you remember, I read a week and a half ago on morality and things and sloth and stuff. You know, she really has some very, very astute perceptions of our age. And one thing she commented, somebody asked her, a reporter, she hated reporters, but they were always coming after, asked her, she must have been in her 50s or something, do you ever read modern novels? And she said, you know, as little as possible. You know, I really don't read modern novels. And although she did, you know, I mean, she looked through them. She didn't read them very carefully. And they said, well, why not? And she quit back to him. As I grow older and older and totter towards the tomb, I find that I care less and less who goes to bed with whom. Her comment on the modern novel. And I think it's a fairly astute one. As I said, she also had another character. She wrote a lot of short stories called Montague Egg, which is a completely different character than Peter Wimsey, and we have they're in some of the short story books in there. We have some of the Montague Egg stories. He's a traveling salesman in wines and spirits, and he's always quoting from the salesman's handbook. I didn't have time to look up any of those quickly, but there's some really classic little adages and things that Sayers had made up for him. And he's just a middle-class salesman and runs around. Lord Peter's in the aristocracy and has a little bit different thing. One thing about Sayers and her characters, though, is I said she's a very astute had very astute perceptions of reality and what that was. And she came at everything from her Christian foundation and was very concerned with Christian dogma. You know, she says many, many times the dogma is the drama, and that the church had stopped getting excited about what it was saying, you know. So people just kind of, I'm going to read one little thing about in Man Born to Be King, most of you might, if you don't know anything else, you might be acquainted with this. It's a radio play that was put on just after World War II, or during World War II, I guess, and about the life of Christ. It's really good. I would recommend it. It's great for personal devotions all through the church here. And here at the Village during Advent and Lent, we've used some of the plays. And since they're radio plays, they don't need a lot of staging, you know, so they're real easy to do for the most part, unless you start getting tricky about it. But And they're a lot of fun, and she really makes it come alive. But one thing she says about this, she says this about the crucifixion, and what happened to what did, why the church, you know, that the church isn't really telling it as it is, you know, just reading it right out of scripture even. She said, God was executed by people painfully like us in a society very similar to our own, in the overripeness of the most splendid and sophisticated empire the world has ever seen, Rome, mainly. In a nation famous for its religious genius and under a government renowned for its efficiency, he was executed by a corrupt church, a timid politician, and a fickle proletariat led by professional agitators. His executioners made vulgar jokes about him, called him filthy names, taunted him, smacked him in the face, flogged him with the cat, and hanged him on the common gibbet, a bloody, dusty, sweaty, and sordid business. If you show people that, they are shocked. So they should be. If that does not shock them, nothing can. If the mere representation of it has an air of irreverence, what is to be said about the deed? It is curious that people who are filled with horrified indignation whenever a cat kills a sparrow can hear the story of the killing of God told Sunday after Sunday and not experience any shock at all. So she was very concerned that the church, you know, get back to revitalizing. Another thing she said about the fun about the Gospels, when she was putting together Man Born to Be King, I couldn't find the exact quote, but I think I've got it in my head pretty well. She talks about, while she was working on the Man Born to Be King, she was concerned, it was really hard to do, put together a play. And she said the biggest problem were the Gospels themselves, because they're proclamation, you know. They're not, you know, I mean, they tell the history, you know, the story of our Lord on the earth, but they're proclamation telling who he is, you know, and all the things he's saying. And it's not really like a newspaper article, you know, running through about Jesus got up and Jesus did this and Jesus did everything else, you know. And she said, that one thing, it really struck her. The whole thing has to be true. Because nobody, you know, making up anything would have been that slipshod in presenting it. And I think that that's really fun, you know. No author creating a work would ever have written the Gospels like they are. It's got to, you know, it's got to be true. So she was really fun in doing that too. She also had a real good spirit of inquiry, and she deals with it in all kinds of ways. This is another mystery she wrote called The Documents in the Case, which is a series of letters about a mystery. It's not a Lord Peter story at all, and she wrote in collaboration with a guy named Robert Eustace, who was kind of a scientific advisor to the Detection Club. He collaborated with many others on it. And in this book, she deals very, very well with some of the things that are of value in our society, too. You know, the value of life, the meaning of life. She deals with the whole thing that science is able to you know, start making life in test tubes and all this kind of thing. When she wrote that. And she has a real fun, one of the characters is a writer who's engaged to another writer. She always wrote about writers. I think she sort of lived vicariously in that. And this guy in his letters is always dealing with all these issues about, you know, he's meeting all these scientists and things, and he's writing a biography of somebody, I can't remember, but he has to deal with them all about life and science and technology and its effect on theology, and goes on and on and on. And this is fun. I mean, she's able to, you know, to honestly speak about the kind of doubts and things we have, and he ends one letter like this: praise God, or whatever it is, from, if direction exists, whom, if personality exists, all blessings, if that word corresponds to any percept of objective reality, flow, if Heraclitus and Bergson and Einstein are correct in stating that everything is more or less flowing about. And I think that's a really good statement on the kinds of inquiry and things that go on, you know, when you start bringing science and stuff into it. And, you know, it's healthy stuff. But I recommend this to you. I just reread this about a month ago, and I really enjoy it very much. Particularly her characters in here are very good. You'll see a lot of people you know in this book, more than any of her others. You really will. Documents in the Case. We have this in the bookstore also and in the library. One thing that was very, very important to her, I was going to read this, how are we doing here, her was that the one thing that really brought home the gospel to her, I mean, she'd grown up in an Anglican parsonage and all this stuff, but like all the rest of us that have, you know, grown up in the church too, I think, you know, you come to that point where you look and say, well, what was all that about? And then all of a sudden the gospel comes to you and it's real exciting. And that happened with Sayers too. And it happened to her sort of by means of her own studying. and things she learned when she was little. Now, granted, her education was a little different than a lot of us. Maybe some of you that are a little older had learned about, you know, had children's stories about Greek history and Roman history and things like that. I didn't, but I wish I had, because they're such great stories. But she talks about Cyrus the Persian, who she read about, you know, just a story about Cyrus when she was little. And also about Ahasuerus, who's the king in the Book of Esther. And she talks about she knew those people in history, and then she knew the Bible over here, and it was sort of something else that was kind of constrained by itself, you know. And then history was over here. And then all of a sudden she discovered in the Bible that in Isaiah and in Daniel, there's Cyrus. And she said, that's the same Cyrus the Persian that was back there in history. And she goes, wow, you know, that's really exciting. And then when she was in Oxford, just some historical stuff. You know, she's working on a paper or an essay or something like that. And somebody's talking about Ahasuerus. And then in parentheses it says, or Xerxes. And she goes, Xerxes? I know about Xerxes, you know. And then Ahasuerus, he's in the Bible, you know, and she brought those two together. And so that got to be a really important thing in terms of her talking about Jesus. Because he's got to be, you know, he has to be real. The most important thing is that he was historical. He came in our time as we understand time. You know, God became man. And the incarnation was vitally important to her. And she tries to, in this one essay, tries to bring that to bear in what would, she says, we miss that connection a lot of times. You know, it took her a long time to discover it. And we miss it sometimes because the Bible's just the Bible and it's kind of like, oh, yeah, well, that's the Bible. But that it really is in our space and time. And so she says this. Let us pretend for a moment that Jesus is a real person who died with a living memory and that John, namely the evangelist John, is a real author producing a real book. That is the only thing she said the contemporary society says that can be real is what we know to be real right here, huh? What sort of announcement shall we look for in the literary page of an ordinary newspaper? Let us put together a brief review. This is a brief review of the Gospel of John, huh? Altering some of the names a little to prevent that Bible feeling. It says, A Memoirs of Jesus Christ by John Bar Zebedee, edited by the Reverend John Elder, Vicar of St. Faith, Ephesus. The general public has had to wait a long time for the intimate personal impressions of a great preacher, though the substance of them has for many years been familiarly known in church circles. The friends of Mr. Bar Zebedee have frequently urged the octogenarian divine to commit his early memories to paper. This he has now done with the assistance and under the careful editorship of the Vicar of St. Faith. The book fulfills a long-felt want. Very little has actually been put into print about the striking personality who exercised so great an influence upon the last generation. The little anonymous collection of sayings by Q is now, of course, out of print and unobtainable. This is the less regrettable in that greater part of it, and that the greater part of it has been embodied in Mr. J. Mark's brief obituary study and in the subsequent biographies of Mr. Matthews and Mr. Lucas, who unhappily was unable to complete his companion volume of the Acts of the Apostles. But hitherto, all these reports have been compiled at second hand. Now, for the first time, comes the testimony of a close friend of Jesus, and as we should expect, it offers a wealth of fresh material. I won't read the whole thing because it's quite long, but I love the last paragraph. Finally, the author of these memoirs reveals himself as that delightful rara avis, a born writer. He commands a fine economy and precision in the use of dialogue. His character sketches, as in the delicate comedy of the blind beggar at the pool of Siloam, are little masterpieces of quiet humor, while his descriptions of the meal in the upper room, the visit of Simon Bar-Jonah and himself to the sepulchre, and the last uncanny encounter by the Lake of Tiberias are distinguished by an atmospheric quality which places this account of the Nazarene in a category apart. And she goes on also to say at the end of this that, and her conclusion too, which is a good one, she says, part of the problem with the Bible being over there, you know, and history being over there, and why we get them together again, she says, nor, one is led to imagine, did Christ ever use any ordinary behavior that is not expressly recorded of him. We are twice told that he wept, but never that he smiled, the inference being that he never did smile. Similarly, no doubt, we may infer that he never said please or thank you. But perhaps these common courtesies were left unrecorded precisely because they were common, whereas the tears were, so to speak, news. True, we have lately got into the habit of headlining common courtesies. The newspaper that published the review of St. John's memoirs would probably have announced on a previous occasion, Prophet Smile, The prophet of Nazareth smiled graciously yesterday morning on inviting himself to lunch with little Mr. Zacchaeus, a tax collector, who had climbed into a sycamore to watch him pass. St. Luke, with a better sense of style, merrily records that. He looked up and saw him and said unto him, Zacchaeus, make haste and come down, for today I must abide in thy house. And he made haste and came down and received him joyfully. Politeness would suggest that one does not commandeer other people's hospitality with a morose scowl, and that if one is received joyfully, it is usually because one has behaved pleasantly. It is usually because one has behaved pleasantly. But these considerations would, of course, apply only to real people. Altogether man with a rational mind and human body. It is just as well that from time to time Cyrus should march out of Herodotus into the Bible for the synthesis of history and the confutation of heresy.
What?
Oh, this book is called Christian Letters to a Post-Christian World, which is currently out of print. I don't know if Erdmans is going to bring it out again, but we do have a copy of this in the library, and I recommend it. It's a collection of essays by Sayers. A lot of them fun. I read out of this one for my Vespers before. Sayers wrote all kinds. He just was continually pouring out essays about Christianity. We have a lot of all kinds of topics too. We have a fun little book in the bookstore, two little essays entitled Are Women Human? You know. And I'll read you a couple things about what she has to say about women. But I wanted to say something else about history and what she says about Christ. This is the man born to be king again. For Jesus Christ is unique. Unique among gods and men. There have been incarnate gods aplenty, and slain and resurrected gods not a few. But he is the only God who has a date in history. And plenty of founders of religions have had dates, and some of them have been prophets or avatars of the divine, but only this one of them was personally God. There is no more astonishing collection of phrases than that which, in the Nicene Creed, sets these two statements flatly side by side. Very God of very God, he suffered under Pontius Pilate. All over the world, thousands of times a day, Christians recite the name of a rather undistinguished Roman proconsul, not in execration, Judas and Caiaphas, more guilty, get off with fewer reminders of their iniquities, but merely because that name fixes within a few years the date of the death of God. And think about that next time you say the Nicene Creed, you know, suffered under Pontius Pilate. But, you know, it's really, really great. One other thing about her, probably her major theological work is... I hate to say, I have trouble saying Dorothy Sayers is a theologian, because I think when we all hear theologian, you think of seminary professors and the like, you know. But Dorothy Sayers was just a lay person who had a gift and a calling to talk about the gospel in her time, and she did it. And she did it very well. And one thing that's lovely about it is it's eminently accessible. She has a good sense of humor, as you've seen, and it's very readable. She really knew how to use the language, huh? It's not tough stuff to get into at all. The Mind of the Maker is probably like her. That's her big work, kind of. Many people say it's the best. What's the word I want? Exposition of the doctrine of the Trinity, to be written in the 20th century. What? Yes. It's sort of half in print by this little tiny publishing house in New Jersey, and you can get it. Luther Seminary Bookstore. You can get it occasionally. They don't, you know, it's probably one of, they probably print 100 copies a year or something. I don't know. It's in print, but barely. Greenwich Press or something. It's a real small one. Anyway, it's a really fun book, and if you can get a hold of it somewhere, I don't know if we even have one in the library. I'm not sure. I have to do something about that. But, or she talks about the Trinity and compares it to authors' writing. It's hard to talk about, but it's well done. this book we do have in the bookstore and also in the library, although Thea has the library copy right now, I think. And it's called A Matter of Eternity, and this woman, Rosamund Kent Sprague, has just taken little snippets from all of Dorothy Sayers' writings. Most of her stuff is out of print now, most of it. And if you're going to buy one thing of Sayers or have one thing, I'd recommend this, because it'll give you a good breadth of all the different things she did. She quotes from almost everything she wrote, and including a poem at the end that hadn't been published before called For Timothy and the Co-Inherence. And the co-inherence is something that Charles, with a word of Charles Williams, I won't get into Williams, that'd be a whole other thing. Greg Stieber used Descend into Hell and Vestments in that. And the co-inherence of all things. They were all so much, they understood, you know. Libby said to that she was, you know, wanted to talk about the totality and that thing. And this is just what Sayers and Williams did, you know. The incarnation for them really meant that Christ came to redeem the whole world, you know. The rocks and the, you know, and everything else. And everything flows together, you know. And when you're in the gospel, you can see that and you live with that, you know. Everything has consequences on everything else. You do that. And so they live in this coherence. And it's terrific stuff. And it's good. And Timothy was her cat. And this gives you a little idea of the coherence, too. But it starts out, I'm reading the whole thing, but she says, consider, O Lord Timothy, thy servant's servant. We give him this title as to thy servant the Pope, not knowing a better. Him too thy ministers were observant to vest in white and adorned with a silk coat. It was a white cap. Anyway, the very last stanza I like a lot. She says, when the ark of the new life grounds upon Ararat, grant us to carry into the rainbow's light in a basket of gratitude the small milk-white silken identity of Timothy, our cat. And that's good. I'm going to read you a couple things from here. I saw this one little quote, and like I was telling Paul this earlier, Paul's wife, Carol, and I on Saturday went to go see Saturday Night Fever when I was in Seattle, which is a much better movie than I expected it to be. And the hero in it, how many of you have seen it, I don't know, but the hero in it has a brother who was a priest, Roman Catholic priest, and he quits the priesthood, and he comes home, and everybody's all upset, you know, and because he quit. And he's talking to his brother that night and telling him why I left the priesthood. And one thing he says is, every time I looked at a crucifix, it got to the point where I'd look at a crucifix, and all I'd see would be a man on a cross. And both Carol and I wanted to stand up and scream, that's what you're supposed to see, you know. You know, it's, that's what it is. This is one little quote from Creed and Chaos, from Sayers. She says, if the church is to make any impression on the modern mind, we will have to preach Christ and the cross. You know, and that ties in, too, with that quote I read from Man Born to Be King. You know, people should be offended. They should be shocked by the preaching of the gospel. You know, and that's a big thing for Sayers also. Oh, my. There's so much that... Oh, this is that thing about the dogmas, the drama. Officially, Christianity of late years has been having what is known as a bad press. We are constantly assured that the churches are empty because preachers insist too much upon doctrine. Dull dogma, as people call it. The fact is the precise opposite. It is the neglect of dogma that makes for dullness. The Christian faith is the most exciting drama that ever staggered the imagination of man. And the dogma is the drama. Oh, here's a little quote from the mind of the Maker when she talks about the incarnation a little bit. She says, it was said sneeringly by someone that if a clam could conceive of God, it would conceive of him in the shape of a great big clam, naturally. And if God has revealed himself to clams, it could only be under conditions of perfect clamhood, since any other manifestation would be wholly irrelevant to clam nature. Yeah, yeah, that's good. Now, this is a good one, too. Now, we may call Christian doctrine exhilarating, or we may call it devastating. We may call it revelation, or we may call it rubbish. But if we call it dull, then words have no meaning at all. That God should play the tyrant over man is a dismal story of unrelieved oppression. That man should play the tyrant over man is the usual dreary record of human futility. But that man should play the tyrant over God and find him a better man than himself is an astonishing drama indeed. Any journalist hearing of it for the first time would recognize it as news. Those who did hear it for the first time actually called it news, and good news at that, though we are apt to forget that the word gospel ever meant anything so sensational. More, about the same topic. Let us, in heaven's name, drag out the divine drama from under the dreadful accumulation of slipshod thinking and trashy sentiment heaped upon it, and set it on an open stage to startle the world into some sort of vigorous reaction. If the pious are the first to be shocked, so much the worse for the pious. Others will pass into the kingdom of heaven before them. If all men are offended because of Christ, let them be offended. But where is the sense of their being offended at something that is not Christ and is nothing like him? We do him singularly little honor by watering down his personality until it could not offend a fly. Surely it is not the business of the church to adapt Christ to men, but to adapt men to Christ.
I think that's really a good one. I did mark these out right there. Oh, this is a good one on morality in our time and stuff like that. And this is about Dante. Charles Williams was the big Dante person. They were all involved. Sayers, as you may know, I'm sorry this is so disjointed tonight. I'm sort of but was involved with C.S. Lewis and Tolkien and that whole group called the Inklings. They were really a men's club, huh? You know, Tuesday in Lewis's rooms and Thursday in the pub that had such good ale that Lewis wouldn't tell the name of the pub. But what's it called?
The Bird and Baby.
The Bird and Baby? But Sayers did get together with them eventually, and they all wrote letters and did things like that. And Dante was real important for all of them. And part of it was what Williams called the theology of romantic love, you know, and that God's love, you know, comes into our love too. And there's something in Dante about Dante's love for Beatrice that tells us something about God's love for us and how also we relate to each other. And Sayers says something about all that here. She says, during the last 50 years or thereabouts, and this is would be the end of the 40s, so this is the first half of the century she's talking about. During the last 50 years or thereabouts, we have come to believe that the basis of all love is sexual, and that therefore any and every love which does not issue in sexual satisfactions is warped in its nature and in its effects. And by our belief we make it so, for we bring to bear upon the unfortunate lover all the relentless one-sided pressure of our current critical assumptions. But when Dante loved, it was otherwise. The denial of a physical desire was not then looked upon as a solecism, nor had the achievement of happiness been erected into a moral obligation. The lover who had set his heart upon the unattainable suffered, no doubt, the usual bodily frustrations, but he was not haunted by a guilty sense of personal failure and social inadequacy. He was not despised as an escapist. Nobody told him that he was maladjusted, or hinted that there was something seriously wrong with him if he was not uproariously releasing his repressions at every turn. On the contrary, he was admired and commended. Whatever his private distresses, he could feel that his public conduct was irreproachable. He was sustained by his whole culture.
Yeah, that's a good one, too.
And then here's another one about what she says about our age. The popular mind has grown so confused that it is no longer able to receive any statement of fact except as an expression of personal feeling. And the proper question to be asked about any creed is not, is it pleasant, but is it true? Let's see. Oh, I love, this is one of my favorites too. God did not abolish the fact of evil. He transformed it. He did not stop the crucifixion. He rose from the dead. Oh, she has some good stuff on evil and the devil too, and she talks a lot about the devil and William, all these people do, you know, that we have to regard the devil's a fallen angel, you know, and we have to regard it as a real person, you know, not just some sort of something somebody's made up, but there's really the devil around. And she says we are reminded of the old lady who rebuked someone for saying what the devil on the ground that she did not like to hear him speak so flippantly about a sacred personage. She was real big on sin and on the seven deadly sins, and she has many of her essays deal with that subject and how we need to get back to that basis of really acknowledging what sin is. C and I had a good talk this afternoon about that, you know, that it's really important to, you know, to be able to know that that's a sin. You know, it's part of the gift of sinning boldly, huh? I won't talk about all Thea's Vespers shit, good stuff. Look for Thea's Vespers, I'm right. But, and the whimsy novels do that very well also. We'll get back to those for a second, because you read those and you think, at least I do, I think, my word, you know, every one of the novels you could go through and you could put one of the seven deadly sins on the cause for the murder or the crime or whatever it was that's the center of the book. And the thing is, what's scary about it, or what's neat about it too, because you can see that so clearly in them, is that they're not outrageous crimes. You know, they're not your international jewel theft. They aren't like, you know, the spy stories we have today or anything like that. They aren't your terrific things. You know, they're your friendly neighborhood crimes. You know, they're the kind of thing that you or I could do
if any one sin in us grew to such a proportion that it completely controlled us. You know? They're the precisely the kinds of crimes or murder, or, you know, you can just see exactly that if it weren't me, it might be my next door neighbor that might do that. You know, they're down home. You know, so you see very clearly what the effect of sin and evil is in the world, and, you know, then there's real, you know, then the power of the gospel, and you've heard that, really comes through that. And so there, you know, there's a little teaching in the novels, too. You know, get that in. Whatever. So she liked the Seven Deadly Sins a lot and thought that those titles were important. But she has really great stuff. Even better than her stuff about sin is her stuff about forgiveness. And I'm going to read a few things. We should have a little time to chat, just a little bit. But this is, I forget. Well, God does not, and man dare not, demand repentance as a condition for bestowing pardon. Repentance remains an essential condition for receiving it. Huh. Hence, the Church's twofold insistence. First, that repentance is necessary, and secondly, that all sin is pardoned instantly in the mere fact of the sinner's repentance. Nobody has to sit about being humiliated in the outer office while God dispatches important business before condescending to issue a stamped official discharge accompanied by an improving lecture. Yeah. Like the father of the prodigal son, God can see repentance coming a great way off and is there to meet it. And the repentance is the reconciliation. Isn't that good? Mm-hmm. I really like that. These are two. Really good, too. It may be easier to understand what forgiveness is if we first clear away misconceptions about what it does. It does not wipe out the consequences of the sin. The words and images used for forgiveness in the New Testament frequently have to do with the cancellation of a debt. And it is scarcely necessary to point out that when a debt is canceled, this does not mean that the money is miraculously restored from nowhere. It means only that the obligation originally due from the borrower is voluntarily discharged by the lender. If I injure you and you sue me in damages, then I bear the consequences. If you forbear to prosecute, then you bear the consequences. If the injury is irreparable and you are vindictive, injury is added to injury. If you are forgiving and I am repentant, then we share the consequences and gain a friendship. And in every case, the consequences are borne by somebody. The parable of the unmerciful servant adds a further illuminating suggestion that forgiveness is not merely a mutual act, but a social act. If injuries are not forgiven all around, the grace of pardon is made ineffective, and the inexorable judgment of the law is forced into operation. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is good. This one. I read this next one and I just go, oh, I mean, I'm sure everybody in the room will be able to go, this has happened to me. if you haven't, tell me your trick, I don't know. But the blessed joyously forgive themselves, a thing, as we all know, extremely difficult in this life because pride gets in the way. For instance, that dreadfully silly and unkind thing you said to poor Miss Smith when you were quite a child. Even after all these years, it makes you turn hot and writhe on your pillow if you remember it suddenly in the middle of the night. And the fact that Miss Smith was so decent about it makes you feel all the worse. But in heaven, when you have purged off the sin, you will remember the wretched little episode only as fact. You will be free forever from the ugly shame that is the protest of your pride against being humiliated in your own eyes. And seeing Miss Smith as God sees her, you will rejoice in her beautiful charity as though it had been something else, and not your unthinking cruelty that called it forth. I love that, though. Makes you turn hot and writhe on your pillow if you remember it suddenly in the middle of the night. Ooh, that just happened to me. Well, it happens to me all the time, but it's usually not far away stuff. But I've just been going through a lot of pictures and things, and pictures I've had since I was a little girl, and putting them in order, you know, and I see people, and I thought, oh, you know, remembering what I did, and go, oh. Some pictures of I chased my best friend around the backyard once when I was 7 with a baseball bat. I was furious, you know, and I'm sure that scarred her for life, you know. That came back to me all the time when I saw a picture of her. Anyway. Terrible temper. Okay, here's one or two things about women. And Sayers probably, I don't think, wouldn't have liked the feminist movement in our time very much. But she saw nothing. She thought it was really stupid that people couldn't use their, she had a real strong sense of vocation. You know, we've all been given gifts, and everybody should have the opportunity to be able to use those gifts in the church and whatever, you know. And
She just said that's just a fact. And she talked about Jesus and women too, which is fun. And she got into a lot of trouble in her day too, because she was very aggressive and she didn't put up with any, you know, fuss too, you know. Well, I'll read a couple things here. She says there's perhaps only one human being in a thousand who's passionately interested in his job for the job's sake. The difference is that if that one person in a thousand is a man, we simply say that he is passionately keen on his job. If she is a woman, we say she's a freak. She says, I think I've never heard a sermon preached on the story of Martha and Mary that did not attempt somehow to explain away its text. Mary's, of course, was the better part. The Lord said so, and we must not precisely contradict him. But we will be careful not to despise Martha. No doubt he approved of her, too. We could not get on without her, and indeed, having paid lip service to God's opinion, we must admit that we greatly prefer her. For Martha was doing a really feminine job, whereas Mary was just behaving like any other disciple, male or female, and that is a hard pill to swallow. And one other quick one. Perhaps it is no wonder that women were first at the cradle and last at the cross. They had never known a man like this man. There never has been such another. A prophet and teacher who never nagged at them, never flattered or coaxed or patronized, who never made arch jokes about them, never treated them either as the women, God help us, or the ladies, God bless them, who rebuked without querulousness and praised without condescension, who took their questions and arguments seriously, who never mapped out their sphere for them, never urged them to be feminine or jeered at them for being female, who had no axe to grind and no uneasy male dignity to defend, who took them as he found them and was completely unselfconscious. There is no act, no sermon, no parable in the whole gospel that borrows its pungency from female perversity. Nobody could guess from the words and deeds of Jesus that there was anything funny about women's nature. Yeah, that's a good one. Let's see. I guess that's... Well, one... Can you take one more? Okay. This is about work. The church's approach to an intelligent carpenter is usually confined to exhorting him not to be drunk and disorderly in his leisure hours and to come to church on Sundays. What the church should be telling him is this, that the very first demand that his religion makes upon him is that he should make good tables. Church by all means, and decent forms of amusement certainly, but what use is all that if in the very center of his life and occupation he is insulting God with bad carpentry? No crooked table legs or ill-fitting drawers ever, I dare swear, came out of the carpenter shop at Nazareth. Nor, if they did, could anyone believe that they were made by the same hand that made heaven and earth. No piety in the worker will compensate for work that is not true to itself. For any work that is untrue to its own technique is a living lie. Yet in her own buildings, in her own ecclesiastical art and music, in her hymns and prayers, in her sermons, and in her little books of devotion, the church will tolerate or permit a pious intention to excuse work so ugly, so pretentious, so tawdry and twaddling. Sayers really had a thing on this. So insincere and insipid, so bad as to shock and horrify any decent craftsman. And why? Simply because she has lost all sense of the fact that the living and eternal truth is expressed in work only so far as that work is true in itself, to itself, to the standards of its own technique. She has forgotten that the secular vocation is sacred, forgotten that a building must be good architecture before it can be a good church, that a painting must be well painted before it can be a good sacred picture, that work must be good work before it can call itself God's work. That could raise some interesting discussion, I think. I don't know if I completely agree with her on that, but this is just, you know, I just tried to give you some snippets of, obviously she you know, she just had a wealth of of information and you know, was widely read and really, you know, she very, you know, really observed things well. Interesting. There's one other thing I wanted to read. I can't miss it. The Mind of the Maker. Anyway, something about all the disciples and Jesus too with halos on them. That's how we always see them. But any questions or other comments by people who read Sayers and want to throw in anything?
What does she talk about in that book? Are women human?
Yeah, it's just two little essays that she delivered in the 30s. Just pretty much along those lines of those two quotes I read.
Is some of that type of thing in that book?
In this one?
Are
Women Humans in the bookstore, too?
Yeah, I know, but is that...
Yeah, there's a section of women where there's a couple things from those essays. But... Anybody else? They're fun, you know. Fun to read.
It's pretty good. You're emphasizing her emphasis on the humanity of Christ. That's always something that needs to attack. She was blamed during the war by, I don't know what bishop it was, and many others that took upon a huge writing campaign against the BBC for putting this play out, The Man Born to be King, because if Jesus said things, his voice was heard on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was a religious publication that came out of that, and it blamed the sinking of the Prince of Wales and the Recluse, two ships that were sunk off Singapore in December of 1941, on the fact the BBC had put out this heretical play on God and therefore punished England. But that's absurd, but it didn't make her popular or accepted. It isn't an acceptable thing to have Jesus be flesh and blood. And certainly that's in St. John, where Jesus says, you know, crunch on my body and, you know, and blood.
Mm-hmm.
God in his kind. So do we. And she's got, when she says God on the cross, that's exactly what it
is. Yeah, and that's, you know, she's just so good at it. In fact, one of the books she put out was called Unpopular Opinions.
What?
Unpopular Opinions. You know, she was very aware, but she didn't. And I think she's really right on. You know, you got to get back to the foundation, and, you know, get back to the centrality of the gospel, and let that inform everything else. You know, instead of coming at it from the other direction, which we do in our day. You know, we're so fragmented, and that's one place where I think Sayers and Williams and Lewis are really helpful. You know, because they can draw you back into the totality of things, you know. The world, you know, that whole world and the universe and everything, you know. And that God is indeed King of the universe, you know, and we're part of that. And they do that very well, and in a way that you can grasp, you say, oh, why didn't I think of that, you know. That's why whenever I read Williams and Sayers, I always say that, you know, oh, yeah, that makes sense. It's just so so straightforward. Yeah, and stuff like that. But
that one statement you read of hers, you know, about the creed, you say, crucified under Pontius Pilate, and what a remarkable, you know, millions of people through the ages have said that.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, getting ready for Good Friday, and I was reading one of the plays, Man Born to be King. I just thought it was so neat the way she. Well, obviously, it's a theological play, I guess, but even then, she has a little short scene. It's only, I don't know, a few lines, half a page. And Pilate's wife has had a nightmare, and she comes in and she tells him, I dreamt that I heard voices saying, Pontius Pilate, saying your name over and over and over again. She heard these voices in her nightmare saying his name over and over. And then in the play, she has background voices saying Pontius Pilate in every language, I don't know, about six or seven languages, just over and over and over. And it really brings it to just right in front of you. That the way she dramatized that idea of hers in the play, I thought it was so neat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She really has a good sense of it. I've just been reading a play of hers called, she wrote several plays. English cathedrals are fond of once a year putting on a play and getting somebody to write it. And both Williams and Sayers did that quite a bit. And one of the ones Sayers wrote was one called The Emperor Constantine. Mm-hmm. And it's fun. I just read her introduction and started getting into it a little bit today. And, you know, she talks about, she goes, well, Constantine's a popular subject in Britain. He was half British, you know, and mm-hmm. and. But then he talks about he's important, he got Nicaea together, you know, and she knows all the historical stuff too. She said, now, you know, people wonder whether Constantine was really a Christian or not, and he wasn't baptized till he almost died, you know, just before his death, you know, or whether he was just using it as a political tool so he could get more kingdoms and all this stuff, you know. But still, she says, you know, he still did call together the Council of Nicaea, huh? And what an important event that was in the church, and then has this play then on the Emperor Constantine. And it's fun. And you think that stuff would be just dull. At least, I mean, I do. I'm not very fond of history. I mean, I like to hear about it, but I'm not very fond of reading it. But Sayers can really, you know, you're just reading along, and, you know, they're talking the same kind of English. You know, she brings in fun little things that
because she knows all the legends, you know, about these people as well as the things. You know, I was reading the introduction and went, that, what is it that Constantine's grandfather was, you know, old King Cole with a merry old soul? Paul knows all this stuff, I think.
Why remember the play?
Yeah, but it's just really fun, you know, and in the play, Sayers, you know, she melts all that together. I'm sure, you know, he called for his fiddlers three. Well, whether or not the real King Cole actually had fiddlers, who knows? But in the play, he has fiddlers, you know? And I think that's great. You know, she can do that, just bring all that stuff together, you know, to talk about the other stuff.
What year was she born,
do
you know?
1893, June 13th. Just a second, I want to find this one other thing. When did she die? December 17th, 1957. They're easy to remember because there's a three at the end of the set. She died of a heart attack on her stairs in her house. She just really burned herself out. You know, she was one of those people, she really didn't care much about what she looked like. She didn't care if she ate. You know, it's a good thing she was married, even though he was a real weirdo. He was a good cook, and he cooked, you know. Although she liked to cook occasionally. She really threw herself heart and soul into her work. And when she died, they say she was just completely burned out. I mean, that's just what she did. She just kind of burned out.
And was writing Dante, wasn't it?
Yeah, she was just finishing the Dante translation. That's a fun story, too. We have her translation of Dante in the bookstore, and the scholars hate it. Some of them really like it, but it's used in universities and stuff, too. But they hate it because she wasn't within the circle, you know. She wasn't within the thing, but it's a real good translation of Dante, and she really tried to bring it up to date. And she also did it in Dante's written in a particular kind of a medieval Italian poetry form. It's for terra rizzima or whatever it is. It's for quattro, whatever. I don't know what it is, but it's four beats and three beats, four three. And no translator of Dante into English up to Sayers had been able to come up with a real good English translation using the same metric form in English. And Sayers did it. Since then, John Ciardi in this country has come out with one that does the same thing. But I think he probably just got mad, I think, or something. Is she going to do that? She's not a Dante scholar. She doesn't have a PhD, you know. And how she got into that was that, granted, she knew medieval Latin and medieval French, and so she had a good start for medieval Italian. But during World War II, during the air raids, she used to, whenever the sirens would go and they'd have to run down to the cellar, she'd grab her knitting and the first book that came to her hand. So she ran, and what she happened to grab once was Dante in Italian. And she started looking at it, and she got intrigued, and she knew the Dante stuff really well, I mean, you know, all that, and came back upstairs and started learning medieval Italian and did the translation. And she died before she finished the Paradise section, and her co-worker, Barbara Reynolds, finished it for her. And, but if you can't get into reading the poetry, you know, the Dante, her notes for those are terrific, you know. Talk about proclamation, that's really her all-time, you know, proclamation of the gospel highs, and it's just terrific, just amazing stuff. I haven't read the whole Divine Comedy yet, but I read all Sayers' notes, and it's really fun. She can really make that stuff really live for you, which is good, you know. I think, I mean, last year or so I've been trying to, I think, it's good to read these people that are bringing old stuff up to date, you know. Mary Hinderly has a thing she used to say, you should always read a new book and then an old book, a new book and an old book. And I think that's a good one. And people like Sayers and also Lewis and Williams and Tolkien, too, by just the way he deals with things in the Ring Cycle, can really help you get into some old things that maybe you wouldn't. I just started picked up from Sayers. I decided to read all the books that Sayers mentions in the novel. And, all right. Well, it's kind of fun, you know. I have to find something, like the Wallet of Kai Lung isn't readily available. But or the Garden of Enchanted Images. She has some really choice ones in there. Comment? Is everybody excited to go read Dorothy L. Sayers now? Oh, that's why I'll say one other thing. Whenever you talk about her, well, that's not that important. But she had a terrific sense of humor and could laugh at most things. Except for leaving her middle initial out of her name, she could not laugh at. One time she saw a placard or an advertisement for one of
her books and or in a newspaper, and it said Dorothy Sayers, you know. And she wrote a nasty note and said that Dorothy Sayers is somebody who plays the banjo or the ukulele in a music hall show, you know. And she told them, I never see anybody leaving talking about Bernard Shaw or or any of these people, and instead of George Bernard Shaw, or G, whatever, how it goes. But she insisted on having that L in her name, yeah.
What was
Angela? Leigh, L-E-I-G-H. It was her mother's maiden name.